This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and these are the stories you don't want to miss. For the week of April 3rd, here are some top stories. A lot of people don't want to talk about sex, but the urge to have sex or be intimate with someone doesn't go away with age, or even if that person develops dementia. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, it's an issue many families face when confronted with such a diagnosis. But at one assisted living community in Phoenix, sex is just sex.
I talked to nursing about that, and I said, you know, it is a twin bed. I am concerned about them rolling out of the bed, but they have mats.
Denise Gutierrez's mother, Lori Thomas, lives in one of the cottages at Huger Mercy Living Center, an assisted living facility in Northwest Phoenix. Thomas has frontotemporal degeneration, a lesser-known type of dementia. Before Thomas came to Huger Mercy in 2015, she lived with a male companion. But when she came to Huger, her companion went to live with his family. Gutierrez says it was a sad time for her mother, but then she met someone.
One day, I came in, and they were just sitting on the bed holding hands, and my mother was elated, and she said, "Look who came back." The way you
wear your hat. Gutierrez says the gentleman her mother was holding hands with looked just like her former companion. He had the same build, even used the same walker. The gentleman's family knows about his relationship with Thomas, and they're okay with it. So does the staff at Huger Mercy.
People think of intimacy, immediately jump right to sexual intercourse. And that could be included. But we have to think of intimacy, we think of it as relationships.
Lisa O'Toole is the manager at Huger Mercy.
Part of the disease process is that unlearning. So we're not thinking as we would usually as an adult, but we kind of unlearn to the point that we're almost childlike, that this is my best friend and I connect with you. Honestly, we encourage it.
Karen Shannon's husband, Matthew, has Alzheimer's disease. He also came to Huger Mercy in 2015. For Shannon, placing her husband was painful. She felt guilty. Then,
one day I came to visit with Matthew and Tom was there. And the two of them were chatting and I chatted with them for a while. And suddenly they got up and left. Left me sitting there and they went on their little walk, you know. So I'm sitting there by myself. I can't tell you. The expression is, for me, is my heart was full of joy.
Marianne McCarthy, a geriatric and psychiatric nurse practitioner at Huger, says intimacy is something we all need from the moment we're born to the moment we die. And that doesn't change even with a dementia diagnosis.
People tend not to touch people as they get older. And I find that older adults, especially those who are in different facilities, are like starving, you know, for intimacy.
Which could explain how someone's behavior could be misconstrued as being sexually inappropriate.
So that term sexually inappropriate makes me just a little bit crazy because we're defining things as inappropriate based on whatever, you know, whether they're our puritanical values or just the whole idea that women become neutered when we get older. You know, men, if they're sexual beings, they're thought of as dirty old men.
To illustrate her point, McCarthy talks about the one time she was called to another facility to evaluate an 87-year-old man who had dementia and was in a wheelchair with an amputated leg.
I remember going back out to staff. I said, really? You know, what did you want me to do with this gentleman? What do you think should happen with this gentleman? And what was it that he was doing? And all he was doing was he was flirting.
That said, some cases do require interventions like psychotropic drugs or even relocation to another facility. But going back to McCarthy's example, it does speak to the need for more, well, sex ed. Michelle Grigaitis-Reyes is a family nurse practitioner at Banner Alzheimer's Institute in Phoenix. In her experience, she says most facilities nationwide aren't doing that.
For example, disrobing. Disrobing can be caused by so many triggers that have nothing whatsoever to do with sexual activity or intent.
In fact, says Grigaitis-Reyes, inappropriate sexual behavior occurs in about 15% of people with dementia and often in residential settings. That leaves a significant percentage of people who are simply in need of human connection. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Drifters off to see the world. There's such a lot of world.
An iconic Navajo activist and matriarch has died. Catherine Smith was best known for standing up to the federal government in the 1970s when it forced thousands of Navajo people to move off their land. She died last week. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Billowing clouds rolled in and out over Big Mountain, bringing wind, rain, snow, and sun, when Catherine Smith said goodbye to the land she loved and defended. Her daughter Mary Catherine Smith was with her in her final days.
In our beliefs that when a death occurs, the weather would tell you how blessed they were, the prosperity, and we see rain, wind, and snow as prosperity. So she was very blessed.
From a distance, Big Mountain appears small, but its importance to the Navajo and Hopi people is great. For centuries, Navajo families like Smith's shared the ancestral land with Hopi. Big Mountain is considered sacred by many. Smith's granddaughter, Davina Smith Spotted Elk, says Big Mountain is where her grandmother and great-grandparents have buried their umbilical cords, a Navajo tradition that ties them to this place from birth.
As she clearly put it, my umbilical cord is buried here in Big Mountain, and this is when I pass on, this is where I will be. That was something always powerful in my mind. You stand up for what you feel is important to you, and I've always tried to do that. I've always tried to instill that wherever I go.
In the early 1900s, the U.S. Geological Survey discovered the land in northern Arizona to be rich with coal, gas, and uranium. As years passed and the population in western states exploded, they looked to the Navajo and Hopi lands as the solution to the sudden demand for energy. Decades later, Congress passed the Navajo-Hopi Land Settlement Act to resolve a long-standing land conflict between the neighboring tribes. But Catherine Smith and many others believe it was all done for coal. Under the law, the federal government redefined the Hopi boundary and took control of 1.8 million acres. The Bureau of Indian Affairs forced as many as 6,000 Navajo and 100 Hopi to relocate. The federal government hired Navajo workers to build a fence at the new boundary. When they came to Big Mountain, they were met with Catherine Smith and her shotgun.
They just kind of laughed at her and mocked her. And she walked back and she said, "No, I'm asking you nicely. You need to stop this work." So they continued mocking her, and then she backed up and she said, "That was a warning." And she shot the gun up in the air. And that's when the workers finally jumped off their equipment and ran.
Activist Amanda Blackhorse, a friend of the family, says this image of Smith has always stayed with her.
It shows me that women are strong and women can be leaders. And she is a hero. She is one of the reasons why I have taken the path that I have taken. And I know that she's done that for so many other people.
When the fence was built in 1979 and the coal mine developed, Smith participated in several protests. At one all-women demonstration along the new fence, police showed up.
And they started beating the women with batons, and she happened to be able to catch the baton coming at her and yanked it away from the police.
Today, that baton, along with Catherine's shotgun, are framed on the wall of her stone cabin on Big Mountain. Next to the gun hang several animal pelts. She trapped badgers, coyotes, bobcats, even mountain lions. Smith raised a dozen children. She sent them away to Indian boarding schools because she believed they would receive a better education than what was offered on the reservation. She was awarded an honorary doctorate degree from the University of Northern Colorado. Documents indicate Smith was 98 when she died on March 29th, but community members believe she was much older. Years ago, Smith told her daughter she wanted to live to be 100.
January, all of a sudden, I heard her say, "I'm 100 years old." And I'm like, "No, don't say that. Let's stay with 98, you know." But she said, that was her way of saying, you know, it's time.
In her final days, she celebrated the news of the Navajo Generating Station's plans to shut down in 2019, several years ahead of schedule.
She kept saying, "I never sold out."
In the 1988 documentary, Heart of Big Mountain, Smith says, "I was born from Big Mountain. That's my mother. So all of my life, I will always be thinking of this place. My spirit will be here forever." Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, reporting from Big Mountain.
You're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, a conversation about off-label drug use and the new Free Speech in Medicine Act.
HB 2382, aka the Free Speech in Medicine Act, it was signed into law by Governor Doug Ducey last month. It's intended to give drug companies the freedom to tell physicians and other medical professionals about so-called off-label uses for approved pharmaceuticals. Advocates are calling it a First Amendment issue. The Goldwater Institute helped craft the legislation, and its executive vice president, Christina Sandifer, is with me. Christina, what's at the core of this legislation, and why is it needed?
This is about eliminating a gag order, a federal gag order that prevents doctors and patients from having the best information about treatment options. This is a situation where a drug is legal, an off-label treatment is legal, prescribing it for off-label use is legal, but it's not legal under federal law to share information about prescribing the drug for off-label use. So you have a situation where doctors and patients are not going to be fully informed. Doctors won't know about all the treatment options that are out there for their patients, and patients, frankly, won't know about potential side effects, perhaps. And so people are not able to make fully informed decisions. So we saw this as a really obvious fix to an area of the law that, you know, that really puts patients and doctors at a disadvantage.
Is Arizona going to be a lone wolf on this? Are there certain restrictions that would still be in place that the feds could step in and say, you know, we're not really sure we're comfortable with this?
States absolutely have the power to protect these rights, to protect these free speech rights of doctors and pharmaceutical companies to share this information. And that's because, you know, the United States Constitution provides a floor for the protection of rights. It doesn't provide a ceiling. So states can and should step in and provide greater protections for constitutional rights when the federal government fails to protect those rights. So although federal law is often supreme when it conflicts with state law, it can never override state law when that state law is protecting a constitutional right that the federal law failed to protect. Here, again, we have a pretty clear issue of free speech rights. We're talking about information that's truthful, that's scientific, and it's about lawful prescriptions. One of two things will likely come from this. Either the FDA and the federal government will step aside, as they sometimes do. But if the federal government were to step in and challenge Arizona's law, I think that would not necessarily be a bad result, because courts have actually been opining on this issue for decades. Pharmaceutical companies have sued the FDA time and time again, saying that the FDA is treading on their right to exercise free speech and to share information with doctors and medical professionals. And each time a court comes to a decision, you know, sometimes it's about a preliminary injunction, sometimes it's a final decision, each time the FDA does something to make that case no longer relevant. So the FDA will settle the case. They'll say, okay, we'll make an exception for this particular pharmaceutical company. We'll let you engage in that speech on this particular drug. And what that does is it stops the courts from coming to any kind of final decision and setting some kind of precedent to clarify once and for all for everybody in the U.S. That these types of speech rights, that this information is protected. And so the law, I think, is very clearly on our side, and I think that courts all over the United States recognize that.
Most of us, fortunately, trust our doctors. People feel maybe differently about pharmaceutical companies in general, especially with some of those almost comical commercials we'll see about the listing of side effects and this sort of thing. Do you see any possibility here, that contradiction between, yes, I trust what my doctor is telling me, but can I trust what the pharmaceutical company is telling my doctor?
Sure. You know, I don't see a contradiction, but I do think that it's legitimate, you know, that there could be trust issues with anybody. I mean, look, you know, some doctors out there are not going to be trustworthy. Some pharmaceutical companies are not going to be trustworthy. But at the end of the day, the question is, whom should we trust to make these decisions? Should we trust government, or should we trust these medical professionals and ultimately patients to make the decision? This law applies not to these silly commercials that you see on TV, but to the sharing of truthful scientific information that's been verified. If the pharmaceutical companies share that information, you know, the doctors are going to be the ones that are going to be able to read it, to digest it, and to translate it for the patient.
Christina Sandifer is executive vice president of the Goldwater Institute. Doctors and patients will be the ones most affected by the new legislation, so we reached out to Valley surgeon Dr. Jeffrey Singer to get his perspective. Dr. Singer, how could this affect what you do and whether patients get a more positive outcome?
it's estimated that roughly 1 in 5 prescriptions in the United States are for off-label use of drugs. And it's a greater proportion in pediatrics because it's much more difficult to get FDA-approved clinical trials in a pediatric group. So right now, when I as a physician, learn about an off-label application of a FDA-approved drug, I usually learn about it either by reading it in a journal, a medical journal, where, you know, a trial was done and it's been reported that this drug actually has a benefit in treating a different problem. Or I go to a medical meeting and I see a presentation by one of the people at the meeting showing that this drug has an application in an area that was not known before. It's very difficult. In the past, it was much more easy, for example, a pharmaceutical representative to share with me information about studies that have been done showing the drug has an off-label use. The pharmaceutical representative can't inform me that he's aware that one of his clients, a colleague of mine in another part of town, has found a benefit by a different dosage or by a different usage of a drug that I'm using. So it's interfering with the information flow.
Should this information be available, frankly, to the public, even if they don't necessarily have the knowledge that a professional physician would have?
I believe on a moral level, for sure, because people have the right to the free exchange of scientific information and ideas. Of course, it's morally wrong to intentionally give wrong information, false information. So on a moral level, the answer is yes. And also on a practical level, people don't automatically believe everything that's told them, but when they hear information, they check it out. And ultimately, the most important person in the patient's care is that very patient. There's a nice value to these commercials that are on TV now, where, you know, it says, ask your doctor about this and this drug, because it does make the patient ask the doctor if there's a drug that may be helpful for them that the doctor hasn't mentioned to them. It also makes the doctors have to keep up to date and on their toes, because they can expect to be asked questions about new products that are out there, and they don't want to be able to not answer it, so they have to go research it themselves. Doctors know that pharmaceutical companies, obviously, they have their own agenda as well, and they have a profit motive. But that doesn't mean that when they pass on information to me, it's not something at least worth looking into. And we also know if they pass on false information to me, they're liable.
Dr. Singer, do you have examples of pharmaceuticals you have prescribed in the past that were not connected to what the drugs were initially approved for?
After you remove someone's gallbladder, there's a syndrome that about 1% of people get, where they get this chronic diarrhea. Well, we learned years ago that Questran, which was the first ever cholesterol-lowering drug, was a powder you take and drink. It binds cholesterol in your intestines. People don't use it anymore for that because there are much better drugs out. But one of its side effects, and one of the reasons why it wasn't that popular, is because it causes constipation. We learned through word of mouth and meetings and conferences and journal articles that we could use that side effect as an effective treatment for those people who have that chronic post-gallbladder removal diarrhea. That's an off-label use we use a lot. Also, the antibiotic erythromycin is a very effective stimulant of the stomach muscles. And there's a condition called gastroparesis, where you get atonic stomach. It can be very debilitating. And there are many different causes. But erythromycin is a very effective drug to use in lower doses than the dose used to kill bacteria as an antibiotic. And again, it's an off-label use. It's so commonly known and used in my specialty that most of us never stop to think that this is an off-label use. We just think of it, that's what you prescribe for this problem.
Valley surgeon Dr. Jeffrey Singer, we've been talking about HB 2382, which Governor Ducey signed into law last month.
In science news, last week, SpaceX became the first commercial company to reuse a rocket to launch something into orbit, signaling a new era for private sector space. But the new space race is being run here in the Valley, too, as Old Guard Aerospace vies with hungry young startups. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbus reports.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The countdown brings to mind missions from the space race to the space shuttle. But this 14-story firecracker, an orbital ATK Antares rocket, was built partly in Chandler.
We have ignition.
This is private sector space, and it's blasting off, so to speak, right here in the Valley of the Sun. And it's big business. A Satellite Industry Association report said global launch service revenues reached $5.9 billion in 2014.
The sector in the Valley is very impressive for aerospace companies. It's a great place for us to come and to work.
That's Terry Feehan at Orbital's Launch Vehicle Division. In 2014, NASA tapped Orbital to resupply the International Space Station as part of its commercial resupply program. But NASA's demands alone could not support a commercial space sector. For that, a new age of satellites was required. And it all started more than 25 years ago with Motorola's wild idea, Iridium.
Iridium was such a big program with so many different facets that it really pulled in a lot of different experts in the different space system domains.
John Hertzberg, now a systems engineer at Tempe-based Kinetics Aerospace, came to Phoenix to work on Iridium, Motorola's unprecedented plan to build a wireless communications network with 77, later 66, satellites. Peter Vetter, also with Kinetics, says growing demand and improving technologies have made such outsized ambitions achievable.
The technology is such today, and the capabilities in electronics are such today, that it's a lot easier to do than it ever has been.
Kinetics' expertise in orbital dynamics still helps guide Iridium, and the company hopes to launch its own constellation of 40 Earth and space observing satellites. But Kinetics also spends time in NASA's orbit. The company has provided navigation for missions ranging from MESSENGER, the first mission to orbit Mercury, to New Horizons, which flew past Pluto in 2015.
We can help design the right trajectory to get to the objective and be able to collect the kind of science that the scientists want to collect.
Orbital moves in the same circles as Kinetics. Its Gilbert facility makes satellites, including Iridium's next generation, and its rockets have both defended the country and launched NASA's lunar dust experiment, LADEE, to the moon.
3,000 feet in altitude. Avionics power systems remain nominal.
Such connections with NASA, with Iridium, create niche markets that attract talent and opportunity. Walt Everetts with Iridium Communications says it's about more than satellites. It's the places that provide expertise in orbital dynamics, programming, communications, the whole array of local talent that makes the system work.
People don't realize how much space industry is based in this valley. It's very easy to find talent. There's great colleges, universities, capabilities throughout the valley that do foster this type of innovative desire.
Everett says the Valley's long aerospace and defense legacy helped create that capability.
Motorola had a lot to do with that. Orbital down the road has a lot to do with that. General Dynamics up the road, a lot to do with that.
But Orbital's Feehan, a retired Major General who worked for Air Force Space Command, has seen traditional aerospace contract substantially. As for new space,
I think the pendulum is swinging from contraction to expansion to where hungry, small businesses are trying to change the way space is done.
Nicholas Gerbus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally this week, in a look at business news, a Scottsdale tech company is rebranding itself as it competes for more business. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Jimmy Jenkins reports.
Taser International came to prominence in the 90s selling stun guns to police departments. A decade later, the company added police body cameras to its production line, the Axon line of video cameras, and the subsequent file management and data storage subscriptions that come with them has become so significant that Taser is changing its name to Axon. Spokesman Steve Tuttle says the new name reflects the company's expansion into what it calls digital evidence management.
We're not just a Taser weapon, we're not just body cameras, but we're all those things that plug in with a network of apps, people, and devices.
Axon employs more than 400 employees at its Valley-based headquarters and factory. Its main competitor, Seattle-based VView, is suing Taser, alleging unethical practices related to the Phoenix Police Department's body camera contract. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Scottsdale.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Made possible in part by Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the ASU Biodesign Institute, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information source.